Hello, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency, devoted to promoting musicians and authors worldwide. Call us today at 941-877-1552 to start your free publicity evaluation. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Please welcome the host of Interviewing the Legends, music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello, once again, everyone. I'm your host, Ray Shasho, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends on BBS Radio, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or email us at publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Neil Ratner quit college in the late 60s and traversed the Hollywood celebrity world as a successful road manager for names like Edgar Winter's White Trash, and tour manager for Emerson, Lake & Palmer. He established a full-service production company, a pioneering approach at this stage to support the artists on tour, and worked with legends like T-Rex, Genesis, Pink Floyd, and many, many others. Later in his career, he managed a successful songwriter, Denise Rich, and built Dream Factory Studios in New York City. Denise was the wife of Mark Rich, one of the world's most successful commodity traders, indicted in the largest case of tax evasion ever brought against an individual in the U.S. at the time. After a successful career in the music industry, decided it was time to follow his heart and pursue his other childhood dream of becoming an MD. Even though not a single American school wanted to take him, he didn't give up and moved to Mexico to get his medical degree. He made it back into the American system, and after many years of residency, Neil became an anesthesiologist. Those are my favorite people, by the way. Traditionally, anesthesiologists worked in hospitals, but Neil had other ideas. He was the first to take the practice of anesthesia out of the hospital and into the doctor's offices in New York City. When propofol became available in the U.S. in the late 80s, Neil was one of the first to become expert in its usage, as it was a perfect drug for office use. His relationship with the top plastic and reconstructive surgeons in New York allowed him to treat a number of high-profile patients. That is how Neil met Michael Jackson. He became his personal doctor and a close friend. They had a lot in common. Neil accompanied the star from late 1997 until his last performance in 2001. Neil became a trusted friend of Michael's from 1994 to 2002, periodically going on tour and spending time with Michael at Neverland. Rock Doc is Neil's remarkable journey about rock and roll and Michael Jackson, Nelson Mandela, a prison sentence with very unexpected results, and how helping the poorest of the poor became a key part of his life. Please welcome anesthesiologist, musician, and author Neil Ratner, the Rock Doc, to Interviewing the Legends. Yay, Neil!
Thank you, Ray. That was a very nice introduction. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Of course, there's a lot more, but I can't get it in.
That's enough.
That was enough, right? It's hard to hear all that about yourself.
Oh, God. I don't think it's me anymore. Like
Well, I hate to say it, but propofol is one of my favorite drugs, only because I've had a lot of procedures done, and that's the drug that relaxes you and, you know, it really prepares you for lights out, you know, and I think it's a great thing, and it, you know, that doesn't make you sick, you know, and like a lot of anesthesia products do, and you're basically one of the, I guess, pioneers of bringing that, you know, to the office, which I've had procedures done in the offices too, as well, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, well, you know, back when I finished my anesthesia residency, I wasn't sure what kind of anesthesiologist I wanted to be. I had spent so many years in education, really didn't want to be a hospital-based anesthesiologist, but as an anesthesiologist, there weren't that many choices. And then when I looked around, I realized that doctors in New York City were not operating in their office, except for very small cases where they'd give a little touch of Demerol or Valium or something. And I realized the reason was anesthesiologists were not comfortable going into an office alone with drugs and monitors that existed back in those days. But having been in the rock and roll business, I had a much different perspective. And I felt that I could handle the drugs, mix them correctly, be safe, and create the right kind of anesthetic experience for people in doctors' offices. So I decided to take the leap and do that. Now, when I started, there was no propofol.
Right.
The gold standard for putting people to sleep in anesthesia was a drug called sodium pentothal.
Right.
But sodium pentothal was very difficult to control, very depressing of respiration and blood pressure, and most of all, nauseating. And the last thing you want in a doctor's office is for the patient to wake up and be nauseous.
Yeah.
Because then the patient can't leave. And if the patient can't leave and you only have a 2-bed recovery room, you can't do more than 2 surgeries. So it was a real problem. And then propofol all of a sudden appeared. And for us anesthesiologists, it was truly a miracle drug because it could be controlled easily. It wasn't so depressing on the respiration or blood pressure. And you shut it off and somebody would wake up. You know, you've had it. You wake up a few minutes later and want to know when the operation's going to happen.
Yeah.
And most of all, it wasn't nauseating. So, yeah, that was a big one for me.
Yeah, the first guy, when I go into the procedure, I've had a lot. I've had a I've got complex pain regional syndrome from a fall from my wrist. I've had a couple of surgeries from that. I've had the ganglion block, you know, on my the shots in the neck, and of course they put you out for that. But the first guy I looked for is the anesthesiologist. And I said, man, you're the man. Take care of me, man. Before I even see any, the regular doctor, it's the anesthesiologist who's my hero because I want to be comfortable, when they go under the knife.
Listen, I hear. let me say this to you, Ray. And I often say it. People loved us when they were in the operating room.
Yep.
But all of a sudden, when they got the bill, that guy.
That's true.
So it was, unfortunately, our medicine caused retrograde amnesia. So as good as we might have been, nobody remembers it anyway.
But the anesthesiologist is so important because, there are risks. And they don't stress that enough. They just make you sign a consent form. Sometimes you don't know what you're signing, but there are a lot of risks when you get put under, and you guys make it so smooth. It's very important to have a skilled doctor, a skilled anesthesiologist like you.
Yeah, no question.
Yeah.
No question. It's serious business.
Yep.
You need a serious doctor who knows what they're doing, for sure.
Well, you took care of Michael Jackson for a lot of years, okay?
Yep.
How in the world did they end up with Conrad Murphy at the end there?
My life took twists and turns, and I left Michael in 2002.
Right.
All I know is the things that I've read.
Right.
And from the way it seems to me, Michael wanted somebody to create the treatment that I had successfully created to him. And apparently he wasn't as aware of the risks and the fact that it needed to be an anesthesiologist. And so somehow Dr. Murray came into the picture and agreed to do it, even though he wasn't really expert at it, and we all know the outcome.
So he just administered way too much, I guess, and he was implicated for this. I guess he went to jail for this, too.
Right. Yeah, he went to jail for it. Again, the best thing I could say about that is he wasn't an anesthesiologist.
Right, exactly.
Therefore, he should never have been doing it.
It's so sad. And I know they just hired a guy. He hasn't been with Michael a long time. He was pretty new, I think.
Seems like that's you know, again, I only know what I've read, and I've read what you've read. And,
yeah.
You know, seems like somebody knew him, and he stepped up to the plate and said, I can do this. And
that's great. That's a shame.
Comfortable, and that was that.
That's a shame, because, you know, he trusted you for all these years, and then they go to someone else out of the blue, which you know, it's very unfortunate.
You know, rock and roll, man.
Rock and roll, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, a lot of people miss Michael. How is Michael? What's your take on him as a person and, you know?
You know, I knew Michael in a much different way than anybody else from the general public, certainly. He was my friend. He was a good friend.
Mm-hmm.
He was a guy that I could talk to about anything that I would talk to, like I'm talking to you. We laughed a lot. He had a great sense of humor. And he was very spiritual,
yeah.
Which people don't know. He was an avid self-help reader and turned me on to many great self-help books. And, you know, he was just a good guy, just an all-around good guy. I mean, unfortunately, I think he created an image for himself, which then was very difficult to handle and control. And it sort of bit him in the ass a little bit.
Right.
And of course, Michael was sort of shy. And so, you know, he didn't let many people into his inner circle. And as a result, he was kind of a lonely guy much of the time.
You know, it seemed like he was a lonely guy. You know, you just get that impression, you know. And
well, you know, he created this world where he couldn't go and do the things that he wanted to do.
Yeah.
And so, you know. And then he wouldn't let people inside his life,
yeah.
You know, except for very few. So, you know, that's the recipe for loneliness, for sure.
I never understood, you know, he was a good-looking guy ever since he was a kid, you know. I never understood why he wanted to go through that facial cosmetic transformation, you know, to change his appearance, you know, because he never...
There's a condition, and I talk about it in the book, called body dysmorphic syndrome.
Okay.
It's a psychological condition where people are never satisfied with the way they look.
Really?
And yes, and unfortunately, I think Michael suffered from this.
Yeah.
You know, it started because he didn't like his nose.
Huh.
You know, he had the kind of nose that he felt he needed to change. But of course, once people start with cosmetic surgery, sometimes it's a never-ending battle because you're never getting it the way you exactly want. And there's always another surgeon who says, oh, no, I could do it better than that guy. I'll give you what you want.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of a vicious cycle with no good ending. And, of course, in terms of the bleaching of the skin, Michael has vitiligo.
Oh, he did?
Which is a condition where parts of his skin would depigment.
Right.
So he had these white blotches all over his body. And as a performer... He couldn't deal with that. And he couldn't make the white blotches darker again.
Mm-hmm.
So the only thing he could do is bleach the dark skin to match the spot.
Yeah, he really transformed into a different person. Because, you know, when you see his old videos and, you know, him with the Jackson 5, I mean, you know, he was a great looking guy. He had, you know, I mean.
Not to him.
Yeah. Yeah.
There
seems like there's a lot of people that are addicted to plastic surgery. You know, one comes to mind was Joan Rivers, and again, that's another tragedy. What happened to her? I you know, was there an anesthesiologist on board at that place? Do you know?
You know, again, that was another propofol tragedy in a sense. Yes, there was an anesthesiologist,
right.
But unfortunately, the anesthesiologist got caught up in the magic of dealing with a celebrity.
Oh, my God.
One thing that you need to learn as a physician, particularly if you're an operating room physician of some kind,
right.
You must treat every patient the same.
Yeah.
You don't treat your family different. You don't treat celebrities different. You have a routine. That's your routine, and that's what you're supposed to do.
Right.
This guy got caught up in the magic of Joan Rivers being in the operating room. He wasn't paying attention, and then... the surgeon brought in another guy. They decided to do a biopsy. The anesthesiologist wasn't paying attention. One thing led to another, and you know the outcome of that one.
Yeah, I always heard, you know, you would it's like almost they didn't have the proper equipment to revive her or something. You know, you would have thought they would have brought her back.
No, I don't think it was that. As much as by the time they realized what was happening, it was a little bit too late.
It's too late, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I don't think people were paying attention as much as they needed to pay attention.
Yeah.
You know, in anesthesiology, let me just say this. You know, we used to say it was moments of terror with hours of boredom.
Right.
The terror being when you put somebody to sleep or when you wake them up. And then if the operation goes well, you're just looking at, you know, monitors and hearing beeps the whole time, right?
Yeah.
But if something goes wrong, you better be aware because things go downhill incredibly fast.
Yeah.
In anesthesia. And if you're not on top of it, you know, you're going to have a big problem really quickly that you're not going to be able to fix.
My wife was a nurse for, I don't know, 40 years. She's retired now, but she was in the emergency room. She did trauma, ICU. She did just about everything. So, you know, I'm you know, really part of that scene. And, you know, she had a lot of nurse friends and doctors and this and that, whatever. So I learned a lot.
I bet you did. More than you wanted to know.
Exactly. We still watch all the TV shows, you know, Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah. I understand exactly what was going on.
I want to know, in the hospitals, is it true that doctors and nurses sneak into closets to have sex?
Never happened to me, man. That's all I can tell you. Never happened to me. I never heard it. If it went on, it didn't go on when I was around.
It did, yeah, it did, right? It's new generation now.
What did your wife say about that one?
There was considerable flirting. I can... That's what she says.
Yeah, right. Well, off the record. You
off
know,
the record, yeah.
The expression.
Yeah.
Always the expression, more suction, right?
More suction. That's funny. I like that.
Yeah, off the record.
Yeah.
You can tell your wife that one.
I'm going to tell her that. So, initially with Michael, weren't you hired to detox him in 1999 in Seoul? Didn't he collapse on a private jet or something? And he was on Demerol and morphine, and you initially were called in to kind of get him off that stuff?
No.
Oh, no. Okay.
No. That was not how it happened at all.
Okay.
Basically, what happened was, and I explained this in the book,
right.
I met Michael when he walked into a plastic surgeon's office that I was working at. Now, the funny thing is, I knew one day he would walk into that office.
Really?
Well, when I was deciding on what I wanted to do as a career in anesthesia, and I was thinking about office surgery, I didn't know who to go to.
Yeah.
What doctor should I approach with my plan?
Right.
And then I was in the doctor's lounge. I was in Bethesda Hospital in New York. I was in the doctor's lounge reading page 6 of the New York Post.
Right.
You know, the gossip shit.
Yep.
And I read that Michael had gone to his favorite New York plastic surgeon, Dr. So-and-so.
Right.
And I realized that Dr. So-and-so was somebody in my hospital. And so I devised a plan to approach him on my idea of office anesthesiology.
Yeah.
Having nothing to do with Michael. Michael was just sort of a conduit for me. And he bought hook, line, and sinker, and I became his director of anesthesia. And 8 years later, Michael walked into the office.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
it's an amazing story. You were at Neverland a bunch of times.
I just wanted to clarify something.
Okay.
From the last thing, so he walked into the office.
Okay.
I gave him anesthesia for a little procedure, but we became fast friends.
Right.
I was a real music guy. You know, he liked me. I'd never seen a doctor like me. I liked him, and we developed this intense relationship, really over the telephone, occasionally seeing each other, but mostly over the telephone.
Right.
And then he started to come to New York, and he was spending a lot of time in New York, as he was supposed to do. It was a comeback concert for him. He was going to do two nights at the Beacon Theater with Marcel Marceau as his guest, and it was an HBO special. And so he was in New York a lot, and he was showing up at this office a lot. And then on Thanksgiving Day, I'll never forget it, I think it was 1995, he called me up, hysterical crying, and asked me to help him. And so my relationship as his private physician developed from that, really. By the time 99 came along, I had already been working with him for about 5 years on and off.
Yeah. Were you at his funeral?
No.
No. Yeah. And,
I don't think, back in the day, I'm not sure how comfortable his, management was with what was going on.
Right.
So I was not in that circle to be invited to any of that.
His father was a tough guy too, wasn't he? As far as managing Michael and, very strict, I guess, right?
Well, he didn't have the greatest childhood.
Yeah.
And his father was a taskmaster. His father wanted to make the Jackson 5 successful, and he really didn't have much regard for the fact that they were really children, and Michael was just a little child.
Yeah. What was Neverland like? I know now Neverland is not, it pretty much got deserted after he passed away, and I think it's still on the market.
I think it is too. I had heard that the kids got involved and they were just trying to make it into a reasonable, peaceful kind of place, but right. I'm not sure what happened in here. It was an amazing place when I was there with them, though. Especially the first time I went there and he gave me a private tour. It was really quite incredible.
They should have made it into a museum or something,
That would have been great, but, I think there were financials involved and all kinds of crazy things, so.
Well, let's talk rock and roll, man. I can't believe, how did you first get involved in rock and roll?
Well, I got involved in rock and roll as a kid because I wanted to be a rock and roll drummer.
Right.
And so growing up in grade school and high school, I played in the school orchestra and I played in the marching band.
Right.
And I had my own band and I had hoped, that I would get a record deal.
Of course.
I'd have to go to college. But of course, as fate would have it, that didn't happen. And, education was important to my family, certainly. And so I decided I would pursue my other dream of being a doctor. The thing was, something happened to me, in between my sophomore and junior year of college that changed everything. I was pre-med at the University of Vermont,
right.
And I was looking for an advantage to be able to get into a medical school, because as you know, medical schools were very difficult to get into with very few spots.
Yeah.
And so I was able to secure a position in a training program to become an operating room technician in New York City. I had to take an apartment, and I took an apartment in the summer of 69 in the East Village of New York, 2nd Avenue, and 1st and 2nd Avenue and 13th Street. And in 69, that was a crazy place, East Village, New York. The Fillmore was down the block, and the Anderson Theater, and the Electric Circus, and hippies all over the place. And as fate would have it, I move into this apartment, and I hear music coming from upstairs. So I have to go investigate, and I go, and I knock on a door, and who opens the door but Rick Derringer?
Yeah.
I didn't know who Rick Derringer was at that particular moment, but we became friends. He played me Hang On Snoopy.
Yeah.
And he proceeded to tell me that he was starting to play with this new guitar phenom from Texas named Johnny Winter.
Right.
And so Rick and I, had a great summer, spent the summer hanging out with him. He was also involved with the Andy Warhol people.
Yep.
Took me to the factory, and I met Andy and all those people. It was an amazing summer, and when the summer ended, I said, Rick, he had heard me play because I had a band that summer. I said, get me a gig as a drummer.
Right.
So 6-8 months later, he called me up and I thought he had a gig for me.
Right.
And he says, Johnny got a brother named Edgar. Edgar's got a band, and I was ready for him to say, and you're going to be the drummer. And he said, we want you to be the road manager.
How about that?
And I said, road manager?
Yeah.
And Rick said, no, do it. You'll meet people. You'll be good at it. Who knows where it'll go. And so I quit college and I became road manager for Edgar Winter's White Trash, starting me on a 5 to 6 year adventure in the music business.
What a break, though, huh?
Yeah, really.
Man, people dream about a break like that, and you knock on a door, and there's Rick.
There's Rick, just like that.
unbelievable. You know, Rick lives a few minutes away from me here. I'm in Bradenton, Florida. And
Oh, yeah. He told me he was living in Florida. I reconnected with Rick about a year and a half up here, and I surprised him. And we had a really nice evening together.
Yeah, he's a good guy. I've seen him at Macy's a few times, him and his wife, Jenda. You know?
Oh, yeah. I never met Jenda. I knew his first wife, Liz.
Right. They're good people. Really good people.
Yeah, terrific people.
I think, I had Bobby Caldwell on this show. He was a drummer for, Rick and Edgar.
Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
Yeah. Also.
I'll tell you a story about Bobby Caldwell.
Okay.
There's a story about Bobby Caldwell in the book. So I'm our manager for Ed Quince's White Trash, and right. All of a sudden, it looks like my chance is going to come. Our drummer, Bobby Ramirez.
Right.
Sad story about him, but his hands look like raw meat. And he played the drums so tough, man. His hands look like raw meat. And I had to take him to a hand surgeon.
Right.
And he needed an operation. And so it was going to be during a time where we didn't have many gigs, but we had one important gig at the Capitol Theater in Dorchester. And I campaigned to be the drummer. And Bobby was my biggest supporter.
Huh.
and it's a funny story because we all lived in a house together up here in Clinton Corners in upstate New York.
Yep.
And they knew I wanted to be the drummer. And they wouldn't let me try out. And the band used to practice in the house. And one night they're practicing and I'm bored. I don't want to listen anymore. And so I go into my room and Edgar's watching me now.
Uh-huh.
And he knows I'm going to go and probably take a lewd and smoke a joint and whatever, which is what I did. And so about half hour later, he comes into my room and says, okay, Neil, now's your chance. Come on in and audition for the band. I said, what are you fucking kidding me? I said, now?
Hey, you should be playing. You should be playing better.
Yeah, well, I played everything at about half speed.
At half speed, yeah, that's true.
And I practiced the songs and everything, and Bobby had taught me everything.
Oh,
and
man.
I failed miserably.
Did you really?
And Bobby Caldwell was a friend of the band, and he got us an okay drummer that night.
Oh, man. What a bummer.
Yeah, well, the band, you know, apologized to me afterwards.
Yeah.
You were right. We should have used it. Yeah, great.
Yeah. I've interviewed a lot of guys from the original Woodstock, you know, Greg Raleigh, and, you know, they were telling me, and Peter Rivera from, Peter wasn't at Woodstock, but they were telling me how they were all, especially Santana, was all on acid, you know.
I'm not surprised. Yeah.
I can't imagine being on acid and with all those people in front of you, you know, and just, you know, it depends on the acid too, right?
Well, it depends on your head.
Yeah.
You know, set and setting, as they say. So, you know, they pulled it off.
Peter Rivera from Rare Earth, he, you know, when he plays, and he sings too, you know, he both, he closes his eyes. And he still does that because he took acid and couldn't handle it, and he would close his eyes while he was playing. And he still does that today.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah. But I think it's awesome that you got a break like that in the music industry. The one that, yeah, I know you were with Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. I've interviewed all those guys. I had a great conversation with Keith Emerson, man. And, you know, I'm so sad that him and Greg are not with us anymore. But
yeah, it is very sad. At least we have the music that they left.
At least we have the music. But I was very impressed that you had a relationship with Pink Floyd, which is one of my favorite bands of all time. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, when I got to England as the tour manager for Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, I was surprised to find that an old girlfriend of mine from the University of Vermont was living in London and had married a guy named Peter Watts.
Right.
And Peter Watts was the chief sound technician for the Pink Floyd.
Right.
And so I reconnected with her. Her name was Buddy, and she introduced me to Peter. And Peter and I became great friends. When the time came that I was ready to leave Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, I had this concept of an all-in-one production company: sound, lighting, trucking, everything a big band would need to go on the road. I would provide for them. They only would have to call one person. And Peter knew that was a great idea, and he knew lighting company in London called Chelsea Morris.
Mm-hmm.
And it was made up of two guys, Bill Chelsea and Jim Morris, and the crew were splitting apart. And Jim Morris was keeping all the equipment and was looking for a new partner, so Peter hooked me up with Jim. And we formed this all-in-one production company called Circus Ballet.
Right. That
was a very successful concept. We did some things for the Bee Gees and Genesis and some little stuff. And then I went back to ELP, and they loved the concept, and so I did the Brain Salad Surgery Tour.
Wow.
And then Peter had taken the Floyd out on the Dark Side of the Moon Tour. The first Dark Side of the Moon Tour, they actually went and tried to do the album before they ever finished recording it.
Right.
They went out on a normal English tour, and it didn't go well. And Peter and the lighting guy, Arthur Max, realized they didn't have enough equipment to do the kind of production that they wanted to do. And so Peter came up with the idea of combining forces with my company. And he went and talked to Steve O'Rourke, who was the manager of the Floyd at the time. I was the CEO of O'Rourke. And we came up with a deal where I would combine forces with them to do the Dark Side of the Moon tour. So the next time they went out, which was, I think, in March in America, it was the combined forces of all of us. And then we did that tour, and it was so successful, Floyd wasn't going out on the road anymore, and O'Rourke said that we could keep this conglomerate of equipment together, and so Peter and I went and solicited more work, and we did the Three Dog Night, and we did T-Rex, and we did a couple of other bands as well. It was very successful.
That's incredible, especially the Dark Side of the Moon tour. I mean, that had to be a massive, you know, production.
It was a massive production, and I have to remind people that this was in a time with no cell phones, no computers, and you can only imagine how difficult it was to keep all these things together. It was quite a chore. I mean, it was an amazing tour, but of course, back in the day, you're on the tour, it's just another tour.
Right.
You know it's great, but you don't know what it's going to be retrospectively.
And plus, they didn't have all the, musicians on stage like they had recently, a couple of guitarists, a couple of drummers, backup and all that. It was just the four of them and the girls singing in the background, I guess, and that was it.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah, that's it. A sax player, too.
No, the sax player, right. That's right.
Yeah, that sax player and they had girls, but other than that, it was just the four of them.
And you had the movie screen right on top, I guess?
We had everything.
Yeah.
We had the airplane that flew on the guy wire and exploded over Nick Mason's head.
Yep.
I even, on some of my trucks, I had huge 40-foot panels painted with the Dark Side album cover.
Right.
And we would drop the trailers when we did an outdoor gig on either side of the stage so that you can see that prism and stuff on either side of the stage in 40-foot. On 40-foot murals on the truck. I mean, we did all kinds of things, which was unique and different for those days.
Well, I want to personally thank you for all you did for all those bands and Pink Floyd especially, because those effects, I mean, to me, I saw Pink Floyd several times. They always had the best stage production. Their music, was like listening to the album when you see them in concert. It's, to me, the best show ever. That I've ever seen.
Well, these guys were serious. They wanted to be their show better than the album.
Yep.
Not even as good. They wanted it to be better. And they worked very hard every night to make sure it worked.
Do you have any good road stories about being on the road? Anything funny?
Do I have any good road stories about being on the road? Like what?
anything crazy that came to mind? Or?
Well, I tell a couple of crazy stories. I'll tell you one crazy story.
Okay.
When I first got in the business and I was Influencer's road manager, I worked for a guy named Steve Paul. He was their manager.
Right.
And I remember early on, Steve called me and said to me, "Who's your road crew?" And I thought to myself, "What are you talking about? I don't know. What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you need a road crew. You better go hire a road crew." So I didn't know from road crew, so I just hired my friends from college, guys who didn't want to be in college anymore. "Why don't you come down and be the road crew?" And it was okay, and it worked out, but I had this one friend who wasn't really road crew material.
Right.
And for months, he bugged me. "I want to be on the road crew. I want to be on the road crew. I want to be on the road crew." finally, I had to let him do something. So I had him come down to our house in upstate New York, and I figured I'll let him drive the band to the gig. He can't get in trouble doing that.
Right.
He wasn't a big guy and whatever. And, you know, it wasn't very difficult. The gig was in the Bronx, and we were in, you know, Westchester. It was a very easy ride, but of course there was no GPS or anything like that
right. Back
in the day. So I gave him detailed directions. Everything was great. Okay, it was Gaylord Park. It was a Howard Dine gig at Gaylord Park. And so I got to Gaylord Park early, and I'm there, and you know, we were sandwiched. It was a three-band show, and we were sandwiched in the middle. And the first band went on, and no, my friend's not there with the band. And, of course, there's no phone to call him or nothing. And I'm getting nervous. And now Howard Stein comes to me, and he says, if the band's not here in 10 minutes, I'm pulling you from the show. I said, what do you mean you're pulling me from the show? And he says, you can't do that. He says, I have to do that. I have a curfew and blah, 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 blah. And so we are already set up. My road crew had already set up to just push the stuff, you know, or up when they push the other band stuff behind. They're on their last song. My road crew is getting ready to put the equipment up, and Howard comes to me and he says, break it down. You're not playing. I said, no, Howard, you got to give me 10 minutes. 10 minutes. Just give me 10 minutes. And I'm freaking out. And then all of a sudden, like 9 minutes later, Kenny pulls up. Everybody is screaming at each other. What's wrong? You got lost. We drove and we got lost. Blah, 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 blah. Okay. Howard says, all right, you could do two songs. Four short and set. That's all I can let you do. All right. But at least we got to play, right?
Yeah.
So we did the two songs. And now, you know, my friend Kenny, you know, he's feeling real bad.
Right.
You know, because he realizes he screwed up really bad. I don't know what to do with him. I said, just go with the road crew and figure out some job for yourself on the way home. I was just so disgusted with him. But one of the guys in the road crew took off with a chick. And he leaves my friend Kenny to drive the truck. And he never drove a truck.
Jeez.
So Kenny drives the truck, and he's got to go and put the truck at the Holiday Inn at LaGuardia Airport. And room there that night because we're loading out the next day to fly to California. And so, I get back, I expect to hear from Kenny, and phone call, and I could tell something's wrong. What's wrong, Kenny? Well, you know, I never drove a truck. Okay. So you know how, with these hotels, you have these concrete overhangs?
Right.
He drives right into the concrete overhang, heels off the top of the truck.
Holy crap.
Damages the concrete, the truck. Luckily, the equipment was okay.
Oh, man.
I couldn't believe it. I told him I never wanted to talk to him again. And that was that, man. But, of course, we're friends to this day, and we laugh about it now.
Oh, my goodness. That's a great story. Was that story in the book?
Yes, it is.
Oh, man. You know what you're doing?
Not many others.
You know what you're doing really cool, too? I want to tell everybody. You've got these little snippets about your history with all these great legends on YouTube, and you tell little stories. You've got, like, I don't know how many videos on YouTube talking about all these, you know, really cool, you know, biographies of bands that you talk about. So I want to make sure everybody goes on YouTube to find you, because you got a lot more to talk about.
I appreciate that, Ray. Yes, I have a YouTube channel, Neil Ratner Rockduck, and on Facebook, Neil Ratner Rockduck. Every day, I post rock and roll stories. Been doing it for the past 5 years.
It's awesome.
I've got a good following there, and I do live videos. So follow me on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, as well as buy the book.
It's all the book is, you know, I've read bits and pieces. But I'm gonna purchase the book, and I've got a book coming out too called The Rock and Roll Chronicles, which I've got a lot of interviews in there. You know, I've got Johnny Winter and Edgar Winter. I interviewed Edgar the day before Johnny died, which was kind of sad.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but yeah, it's you know, you're doing all the right things as far as promoting your book. Are you going to do a book tour or anything?
I'm going to do something. We haven't decided yet, but I'm definitely going to go out, tell some stories, and let people come see me and sign some books. Just don't know how or where we're going to do it yet.
And you're also, we're talking about maybe going on the road or something, right? And playing music?
I'm talking about putting a little show together, a multimedia show, where I can tell a story and play some music, and, you know, we'll see what it develops into. But yeah, we're looking at a few different options, but I'll be out there at some point.
That would be awesome if you can get some of the, like an all-star band together, huh? Like, kind of like a...
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And, you know, tell a little story and then play a song that relates to the story.
Yeah. That, now, I understand, do you speak Spanish fluently?
Si. We hablo de medicina en español.
Ah, qué bueno.
Yes, I speak Spanish, you know, I spent 4 years in Mexico in medical school. And,
right.
It served me well.
I have an interesting background. My brother just did one of those, DNA thing, the testing.
Oh yeah, 23andMe or Ancestry or something. Yeah.
And you know, we always thought, you know, my mom was Cuban. She came from Spain. My dad's family, there were Syrian Jews. You know, they call them the SYs. Uh-huh. You know. And come to find out, according to this first report, 51% of us were Italian. I guess the Syrian Jews migrated. They got kicked out of a lot of places, including Spain. I guess they ended up in Italy. So now I'm finding out I got Italian in me, a lot of Italian, and also there's like 4% American Indian.
Wow. See that? You never know.
You never know, huh? What's your nationality?
Well, I'm Russian Jew all the way.
Oh, Russian.
All four grandparents came from Russian Jew, yeah.
Yeah, my
Russian Jew.
I have an uncle that was a Russian Jew.
Yeah, well, I haven't done my 23andMe yet, so maybe I'm not, you know? But that's what I've been told all this time. So that's what I think.
It's amazing how many things people are finding out, you know? And what do you mean I'm adopted?
Oh, I have good news. I just got an email that my audiobook now is up and ready and for sale on Audible.
Awesome. When is that? Is that out, available to purchase now? Or?
Yes, it's now on sale and Audible. I just got an email. So, very good timing.
That's great timing because you have a great personality and you know who you sound like a little bit, you know?
Who's that?
Paul Stanley.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Not bad. I'll take it.
You'll take that? do you know Gene?
No, I do.
Yeah.
I've heard interesting things about him, for sure.
Yeah, I figure you and him would probably get along pretty well.
I think we probably would.
Yeah. Neil, here's a question I ask everybody. If you had a Field of Dreams wish, like in the movie, to maybe perform, collaborate, stage manage, whatever, with anyone from the past or present, who would you pick?
Say that one more time. I lost you midway.
Okay.
If I had a Field of Dreams, yeah.
Wish to perform with or collaborate with anybody from the past or present, who would that be?
Oh, boy, that's an interesting question.
You met so many people. It's, you know.
Yeah. You know, I never got to meet John Lennon.
Yeah.
And I think John and I might have gotten along, and I think he would have been a really interesting man for me to meet. So I would certainly put him on a list.
Yeah. That's
but you know what? If I really thought about it, I'm sure there's a lot of people I could come up with.
I'm sure.
Yeah. But again, I've been blessed.
Yeah.
In that I got to spend so much time with so many great artists.
Yeah.
And it's been a real joy for me.
Well, you've been you were in the right place at the right time, and that sometimes that's what it takes too, you know. So,
correct.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Neil, you have anything else you'd like to add or promote or talk about?
The only thing I would like to say is another thing that I have spent a lot of time with over the years is charity.
Okay.
And I just want to spend a minute to say, you know, there's a lot of people less fortunate than we are.
Right.
And if you have the opportunity to help somebody less fortunate in any way, go and do it. Because you'll realize that that's where the real joy in life comes from.
I agree. You had a special relationship, too, with Nelson Mandela, right?
I did. And I thank Michael Jackson for that.
Right.
And he was just one of the most, that was one of the most remarkable meetings that I ever had in my life, getting to spend an afternoon with him and talk to him and catching his vibe. And then years later, him helping me to create a charity and actually giving me 5 of his coffee table books to have autographed any way the buyer wanted. And I created a fundraiser with those books, and we were able to raise enough money to start our first little micro charity bakery in one of the townships in South Africa. So,
right.
Yeah, he's a special man. A special man, and he holds a very special place in my heart.
Yeah. Neil, last question. You know, the drug problem, you know, back in our day was much different than it is today.
Correct.
You know, I never hung around people that were idiots. You know, nobody ever overdosed. You know, we were all, you know, and that's the way it was. You know, people were almost like doctors. They knew what they were taking. They knew how it would affect people. But today's gone nuts, man. What is going on with the fentanyl use with heroin? You know, the mixture of those two together. And there's so many crazy drugs that are turning these kids into complete zombies. How do we get help these kids, you know? Is there a way?
That's a big question with potentially a big answer, but all I would say is people have to look into themselves.
Right.
And people have to realize that, you know, dulling yourself, having been a narcotics addict, having been a fentanyl addict, I was ahead of the curve.
Right.
You know, fentanyl is an anesthetic drug. You know, it's the drug we use in anesthesiology for the painkiller. So, I've been aware of fentanyl since I became an anesthesiologist, and
right.
Unfortunately, drug addiction was an occupational hazard of anesthesiologists, and I fell into that addiction with fentanyl. And having come through it, and now being on the other side of it,
right.
You know, I think people have to really look at themselves. And realize that there's a better way. And get the help that they need. You can't do it alone.
Yeah.
And you can't try and do it alone, and don't think that you're better than it. You know, I was arrogant. I was an anesthesiologist. I was addicted to fentanyl, and yet I'd walk on the street every day past a junkie, you know, and he was living on the street, and I would say to myself, you know, I'm smarter than that. I can handle my drugs.
Right.
Well, I was full of shit.
Yeah.
Nobody can handle those kind of drugs.
Impossible.
Don't think you can. Don't start. And find a better way.
Right. I talked to, Chuck Negron about his story, too. You know, that's...
Yeah, well, he's got a heavy story.
Oh,
man.
My gosh.
He was, like, homeless on the street.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah. And, of course, I knew Chuck a little bit because we did a tour for them.
Yeah.
I got to know Danny Hutton a little bit more.
Right.
He was a crazy guy, but...
Yeah. Did they used to mix fentanyl with heroin back in the day?
Never.
Yeah.
It hadn't been synthesized on the street. It was an anesthetic drug.
That's a recipe for
disaster.
It's
only in recent years that it's been, you know, bathtub synthesized and available on the street and cut with heroin.
It's crazy. And then there's the, spice and some other stuff that they're using.
There's some bad shit out there.
Very bad.
Be careful. Yeah.
Very, very bad. I don't think, I don't even think Woodstock had that many issues like they do today, you know, as far as...
Don't eat the brown acid.
Don't eat, exactly. At least they were warm. Did you go to Woodstock?
Start to finish. Richie Havens to Jimi Hendrix.
You're kidding me. Holy crap, that's awesome.
Actually, that was the end of that summer of 69. I met Rick Derringer.
Right.
Hung out with Rick, Andy Warhol, and then at the end of summer, Putty, who wasn't yet Peter Watts' wife.
Right.
He and I were breaking up. We were spending a lot of time in that city apartment together.
Right.
At the end of the summer, she was going on a year sabbatical to Spain. I was going back to college. And she said, I got a present for you. I said, yeah, what's that? And she hands me 4 tickets to this music festival called Woodstock.
Mm-hmm.
And I look and I say, I hate big concerts. She said, well, maybe you'll want to go. I talked to some friends. We started to see the advertisements. And we said, you know what? Let's go. I was there from start to finish. Richie Havens to Jimi Hendrix.
Where were you? Were you backstage or where did you...
I was just a spectator like everybody else.
But it was kind of miserable when it rained, right?
Prior to me being in the music business.
It's kind of miserable when it rained, though, right? All the rain.
Oh, it's beyond miserable.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
It's beyond miserable. I wrote a chapter on it, which I didn't include in the book, but one day I'll release it as just a separate story.
Well, you can release another series, you know, for you.
I may well do that.
Yeah.
And I put it on the internet at times, and I'll do it again. I think I put it on medium.com. But it's a good story about one person's crazy experiences.
Neil, I can talk to you all day, man, because we're on the same level with the, I'm a music aficionado from way back. And,
Dad, I'm real late for my next one, but I didn't care because I was enjoying the film.
Neil, thank you for being on the show, man. Rock Doc is a remarkable journey, inspiring true story. The best of luck with your book, and we hope to see you performing live, and please come to Florida.
I definitely will, Ray, and it was really great talking to you, and I hope we can meet in person one day.
I would love that. Thanks, Doc.
All right, man.
Take care. Bye-bye now.
You too.
Purchase Rock Doc, the brand new book by Neil Ratner, MD, at Amazon.com. Rock Doc will take you from backstage at a Pink Floyd Dark Side of the Moon concert in the early 70s, where Neil's production company, Circus Talents LTD, was providing production services to the office operating rooms of elite New York surgeons, where Neil Ratner, MD, was director of anesthesia. Neil was an aspiring rock and roll drummer, but ended up on the other side of the business working as a tour manager for Emerson, Lake & Palmer and providing production for the Pink Floyd. After a bad attack of kidney stones and a stint in the hospital, Neil had an epiphany and decided to pursue his childhood dream of becoming a doctor. Dr. Ratner became an expert in the use of the new drug, propofol, a drug that would play a significant role in Neil's future. Although Dr. Ratner encountered many celebrities in his anesthesia practice, one would change his life, Michael Jackson. For more information about Neil Ratner, MD, the Rock Doc, visit www.neilratnerdoc.com or www.facebook.com/NeilRatnerRockDoc. Very special thanks to Jeff Albright of the Albright Entertainment Group for arranging this interview with the Rock Doc, Neil Ratner, and of course, the dynamic duo of Doug and Don Newsome of BBS Radio for making the magic happen for each and every broadcast of Interviewing the Legends. If you have comments or suggestions for the show, contact me at interviewingthelegends@gmail.com and please subscribe to my YouTube channel, Interviewing the Legends with Ray Shasho, for the very latest interviews. It's real news, people. And don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of an Eclectic American Family and Their Wacky Family Business, available now at Amazon.com. I have a kind of like a movie trailer on YouTube. Just punch in Check the G's, Ray Shasho, and you will see what the book's all about. And believe me, you will live the story. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Tune in to Interviewing the Legends every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time on BBS Radio, Station 1.